What is yoga and who is a yogi? I think the second question is easy to answer. One who practices yoga is a yogi. But what is yoga? This was about 15 years ago. That I encountered rather comical ideas about yoga. Not only stupid, but comical ideas about yoga. From there we have come a long way. We have progressed a long way. I was told a rather comical story. One of those much harassed public servants, some kind of a dignitary like a mayor of a town, had been asked to preside over a meeting that a yogi was to address. It was something like this, yoga. The secretary told him, the topic is yoga. He said, okay. He was so tired after the day's work that as soon as the proceedings commenced, he went off to sleep. He slept through the talk, which is a great tribute to the speaker. But he was so peaceful and non-exciting, you know. And when the speaker sat down, the mayor's secretary poked him and said, "Hey, please, sir, it is your turn. The presidential remarks, the chairman's remarks." Oh, he's finished. He stood up and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm certain that you enjoyed this interesting address on the benefits of yogurt." We have come a long way from there. And we are stumbling into a new obstacle though it is not really, and are beginning to regard yoga as a set of exercises, psychophysical exercises, meant mainly to promote health, which somehow to us sounds physical. Yet here, there is the breakthrough into psychosomatic medicine and psychosomatic disorders and cures and so on. I'm not anti this definition, because if one looks at the word health and also the word holiness, you know, we are all supposed to be holiness. My own definition of holiness is different. Holiness is a man who has many holes. That's nothing more than more serious than that. Nothing more serious than that. In fact, in truth, the words health and holiness have the same root as the word whole, to be whole, whole. And there is no such thing called physical health. Physical health, physical immortality, eternal youth, you know, that sort of thing. You have seen it. Have you? Haven't you? Haven't you seen eternal youth? Someone who is just about the same age forever and ever and ever? You have. A statue. A marble statue. The statue of David that Michelangelo made. It's today just as old as it was when he made it. So robust and charming young man. And this eternal youth and eternal immortal, physical immortality doesn't exist anywhere else. Physical health is a misnomer. The moment you divide it into physical, mental, moral, spiritual, etc., 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 you have already cut health into many pieces. And that is not health. So that if one regards yoga as a system of psychophysical exercises that promotes health, I am not terribly against this definition, provided we go the whole way with health. Another interesting experience I had long ago, this also about nearly 10 years ago. I had spent about a couple of years in South Africa talking, etc., etc. And I was going on a tour to East Africa. I thought of it taking a holiday on the sea, so I took a boat. It was so warm, so hot and sultry. I looked around, there was water everywhere, but if I jumped out of the ship, I may not be able to catch back again. I couldn't jolly well take a swim in the sea. I looked around, there was a swimming pool. I've never been able to understand how people swim in a swimming pool. Before you have two strokes, you are on the other side. And what else you do? You have to come back again. But luckily for me, I could float. Turn turtle on my back and just float. It's so easy that it's just very difficult for me to sink. There's nothing strange at all. And so I went up to the top deck, to the swimming pool, jumped into it, turned on my back, put on the lotus posture, because I mean I don't have to take so too much space in that swimming pool. tucked my legs in the lotus and then lying down. It was beautiful. For those of you who can enjoy this luxury, it's beautiful. Most exhilarating. Part of your body is above the water, the surface of the water. Your spine and the back are just under. It's beautiful. I was lying down, taking a sun bath and water bath at the same time. One young man, I could see him through the corner of my eyes. Looked. I was breathing, so I wasn't dead. And he wanted to know, what is this trick? He wanted to know. And so he tried to ruffle the water so that it sent waves to see if I'd get frightened. Nothing happened. After about 5 or 10 minutes of this game, he came close to me. "Are you a practicing yogi?" It tickled me so much that I lost my balance. I stood in that swimming pool and I said, "What has this got to do with yoga?" A wooden plank will float on water. A piece of paper will float on water. And don't forget that this ship with all of us in it is floating on water. Somehow we are hooked on to the idea that this yoga must be something special, something mysterious. Can you levitate? Why must I levitate? There is a chair here. If you cannot afford a chair, I am prepared to stand. But incidentally, I won't mention names. Yeah, please don't try to, and please don't try to guess. You have not. I don't think you have met this person I am talking about. One of the yogis in the Himalayas actually told me that he was a great enthusiast for pranayama. You know, the breathing exercises, and he himself told me that during the early days of his yoga practices, when he used to hold his breath for quite some time, he was indulging in this for several hours a day, spending several hours a day on this. And one day it seems his body was actually lifted up, hit the ceiling, and he came down. Luckily, there was no injury on the head, but there was a slight injury on the ceiling. A little plaster came off. You know, there are two lovely words in the English language which are most appropriate in this connection. So what? You hit the ceiling, so what? What is yoga? Yogas chitta vritti nirodha. A lovely little definition. Probably you got one of those books here, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. Yogas chitta vritti nirodha. Chitta is what is chitta? Chitta. How do you define chitta? You can't define chitta, so better use the word chitta itself. What is vritti? Vritti. And there, the correct understanding of this vritti that rises and falls in this chitta is yoga. Yoga's chitta vritti nirodha. You don't understand, do you? Nor do I. That's the fun. We don't understand this. And so we look at, by their fruits shall they be known. So what is the fruit? Tada drashtuhu surupe avasthanam. That's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful sutra. You can write it down find the simplest translation from any Sanskrit dictionary and hold this one sutra in your mind for days and days and discover three new meanings every minute. Tada drashtuhu surupe avasthanam. When this chitta and vritti and their understanding has been achieved, then the seer remains the seer. There is no confusion in the observer. There is no confusion in the seer. I am the seer. Am I the seer? Possibly. Am I the seer? No, the eyes see. But do I know the eyes see? Huh? What do you mean I know? What is it that knows? The mind. The mind should know that the eyes see. How do I know that the mind knows that the eyes see? How do I know that the mind knows that the eyes see? If I create another one there, oh yes, I am watching my mind, watching my eyes, watching you. But again, it is a telescope. It goes on and on and on and on and on. You can go on peeling it. You can peeling skin after skin, and yet there are 1,000 left. I'll give you this maybe play of words. Or lots of words without meaning. I guess many or most of you are practicing japa. Japa is the repetition of a mantra. Right? Perhaps many of you do practice this. Let's say you do japa or repetition of om or soham. Right? Are you doing it? Yes. Do you hear? Do you hear the mantra within you? Yes. Huh? You are repeating the mantra. You are hearing the mantra. Hey, schizophrenics. A whole bunch of schizophrenic. Are you one or two? The moment I ask you that question, you say, I'm getting into trouble. I am repeating the mantra, I am listening to the mantra, and I am watching both these. That means I am three. Is that right? You are repeating the mantra. You are able to listen to the mantra from within you, mysteriously. How this happens is another story. You are repeating the mantra, you are listening to the mantra, and you are standing aside looking at both these phenomena. Heavens, I must be crazy. As you say that, this one also stands aside and you have drawn behind looking at all the three. And you can go on ad infinitum. For the simple reason that this observer is not an object. The observer is the inner light. Don't confuse. Again, the moment one says the observer is the inner light, oh yes, I can see the flame rising here. That is an object. That is not what you are talking about. Enlightenment, of course I know. Look straight down, I can see a blue flame. That's an object of your own thought, imagination, or psychic talents. That's not what we are talking about. And who is the seer? Is there a seer? We come to this crucial and vital question. Is there a seer? There is one enigmatic sutra in Patanjali's. I have looked at quite a few translations. Not that I am cleverer than these translators, but all of them seem to have missed a vital factor there. Drashta drishimatra. If you are ready for this, it's a shattering, I don't know what to call it, it's not a concept, it's a shattering revelation of truth. Drashta drishimatra. Who is the seer? Seer is seeing. The act of seeing is the reality. There is nothing else. The eyes see those eyes. The mind sees the eyes seeing those eyes. The intelligence or whatever it is aware of the mind seeing the eyes seeing those eyes. Full stop. When this takes place, a silly notion called I springs up. Why does it do so? Are there many people of Jewish faith here? I am one of them, I think. For the simple reason that very often if I am asked a question, I answer with a question. I believe it is a predominant Jewish characteristic. Why should it do so? And the answer is, why should it not? We are not asking why here. We are merely observing this phenomenon happening. The eyes see those eyes. The mind sees the eyes seeing those eyes. The intelligence is aware of the mind seeing the eyes seeing those eyes. And suddenly the notion of I see him arises. Only this notion is at fault. You and I are swimming in the sea. The water is placid, calm. And we are a few yards apart. You can look at me, I can look at you. You know where I am, I know where you are. You know I am alive and you know, I know you are alive and so on and so forth. And suddenly there is a big wave. And I don't see you, you don't see me. I am afraid and you are suspicious. I am afraid you are drowned and you are suspicious, I have run away. And the thing that seemed to have been one so far has become two. This wave rising there has created a division, this and that, here and there. There was no here and there before. Before the wave sprang, rose from the surface of the ocean, there was no here and there. It was all one. The moment this wave arose, there is a here and there. I, you. It may be terribly inadequate to call this a thought. I don't know what it is. The mind sees the eye, seeing those eyes. That itself is probably a thought. And that thought is not vicious. There is nothing wrong with that thought. The mind seeing the eyes, seeing those eyes, that's a thought. There's no problem with it. But the notion, I see him, there is some mischief. When you place a kettle of water on the stove, the water boils. It's natural. It is a happening. When the wind blows, the tree swings. It's a happening. These are mere happenings. This is a happening. So long as we are able please, can I have the glass? Thank you. So long as we are able to see, to become aware of the happening as happening, so long there is no problem at all. But it is only when the notion of I am seeing him arises in the mind, then the mind links it with past memory. Oh, I saw him somewhere else. Or I saw the like of him somewhere else. You know, I went to America last time. Oh, they tore me to pieces. Or they adored me. They worshipped me. Or they trampled upon me. All these memories crowd round this one notion. If this notion didn't arise, memory or no memory, they would have nothing to crowd round, nothing to stick on to. It is wrong, therefore, to say that we are full of prejudice. From time immemorial, we have been conditioned for millions of years. And there is the race consciousness, group consciousness, some unconsciousness, all sorts of consciousness. And therefore, I cannot get rid of it. It's absurd. The moment this notion drops, everything drops. The moment that notion drops, that I see you drops, everything has dropped. Memory, karma, what have you? The understanding of this is yoga. Tada drashtuhu swarupe avasthanam. Then the seer remains as the act of seeing. The seer suddenly realizes that there is no seer. The observer realizes that there is no observer. That what he regarded as an observer, what was regarded as a seer, was himself the seen, was himself an image. When you nod your head, you are creating another lovely image of, that is it. That is not. It's easy for anyone sitting here to say, oh no, that's not. Because the thing that tries to understand this is the intellect, which is nothing but a tool of this notion, of I, what you call the ego. Therefore, without congratulating ourselves prematurely that I have entered into samadhi, satori, you know, I can see the light. This light is not a thing that is to be seen. This light is something which illumines. Illumines the very thought with which you think this. Vijñātāramare kena vijāniyāt. He is the knower. He is a silly word. Never mind. You have to use some word. Since all words are stupid, why not use this word? Everything is silly, why not this? Vijñātāram are kena vijāniyat. In Sanskrit, the word he is not there. Vijñātāram, the knower. By what can you know the knower? That's the literal meaning. By what light can this inner light be illumined? Nothing. We have no help here at all, except to be constantly and vigilantly watchful for the arising of this wave, the sudden arising of the wave. I see him. Do I see him? No. Seeing happens. It's not even any expression you use here will be inadequate. It is wrong to say, my eyes see you. My eyes have no power to see you. Pull them out and put them there in that ashtray. They can see nothing. My brain sees you stupid. Take that brain out and put it there. It sees nothing. My mind sees you is an absurd expression because you don't know what your mind is. No mind. Seeing takes place. And that's all that can be said. And as seeing takes place, a silly notion, I, jumps up from inside. Inside or outside, I don't know where. That's for you to see. One who is vigilantly watchful of this intruder is a yogi. Whatever be the practice that enables one to arrive at this is yoga. This ever watchfulness, unblinking vigilance is enlightenment. That is yoga. He who practices this is the yogi.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om 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 Triambakam yajamahe sugandhim pushtivardhanam urvarukamiva vandanan mrityor mukshiyamamrutat Om Triambakam yajamahe sugandhim pushtivardhanam urvarukamiva vandanan mrityor mukshiyamamrutat Om Triambakam yajamahe sugandhim pushtivardhanam urvarukamiva vandanan mrityor mukshiyamamrutat sarvesham swasti bhavatu sarvesham Purnam bhavatu sarvesham mangalam bhavatu sarve bhavantu sukhinah sarve santu niramaya sarve badrani pasyantu ma kaschid dukkha bhag bhavet asato ma sadgamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityor ma amritam gamaya om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate purnasya purnamadaya purnameva avashishyate om shanti shanti shanti
thank you Over to you for any questions. Translations are defective. No. There are certain extremely difficult expressions. Certain expressions can just not be put into words. I'm not saying that even the sutras are ill-translated. Oh no. Each one looks at it from a certain point of view. Even so, the Upanishads, some portions are so... You know what the word Upanishad originally seems to have meant? Sitting near. The master and the disciple sitting near each other, probably looking deep into each other's eyes and communicating the truth. The truth thus communicated has quite a completely different effect from what is read and what is heard. Again, I may not mention names. I read quite a number of books of a very great master. I must say, I wasn't terribly taken in. Then once I went to hear him, once or twice I went to hear him, that seemed to be, there is certain, you know, the inflections and the voice and the tone and something is there. It seemed to be slightly better. Then a couple of times I went to see him, the effect was revolutionary. Books can and do help us tremendously. My guru, Swami Shivananda, used to say, if you cannot have the direct satsanga or company of a holy man, the books are the next best thing. But while reading all this, whether the Yoga Sutras or the Upanishads or Gita and other texts, it's always good to remember that something beyond those words. The meaning is just beyond those words. The meaning is just beyond those words. And that will prevent us from nodding our head, this is the thing that he's talking about. It's not the thing that he's talking about. We are in yoga, in mystic, in mysticism, in spiritual life, we are entering into a realm for which no words have been coined. I'm not saying that the translations or the translators are inadequate. Translation itself is inadequate. Words themselves are inadequate. Oh, they're lovely translations, beautiful translations.
Second part of that then would be, do you think that the rishis, the right wise men of the past, in their attempts to write this down, as difficult as it is, do you think that the modern wise men or saints or sages, rishis, have equal or comparable knowledge or consciousness about life?
I'm quite sure, sir. I'm quite sure of that. The ancient rishis, there is just one little distinction, if one may make such distinctions, is that the ancient rishis do not seem to have been so much driven to commit their teaching to writing. Even the texts that have come down to us are said to be, I am not an authority on this, are said to be notes kept by the disciples. The master himself hardly ever wrote. Notes kept by the disciples. And they have been circulated. I'm quite definite on this, that as regards enlightenment, there is no ancient, there is no modern.
In that regard, Swami
No, no. Modern saints and sages do commit things to writing. Many of them, many of them. I believe among the modern saints or sages, I believe only Ramana Maharshi didn't write very much. Even the 40 verses that are attributed to him, they, I believe, were sort of scribbled and later on put together. He was the only one that didn't write very much. The others are prolific in their production. No, it's not. I didn't say it's difficult, sir. In the hope, in the very fervent and well-meant, well-intentioned hope that this is better than nothing, number one. And I mean, if these books didn't exist at all, we wouldn't even be sitting here together, yes? So, the the container of the knowledge, which is the word, is communicated in the fervent hope that someone might pierce the veil of the word, pierce the veil of the word and see through it. Therefore, even a second-rate, third-rate, third-rate text on yoga is equally good. As a step, that's a step. You read, incidentally, when it comes to these great commentaries on these great texts like the Yoga Sutras or the Upanishads or the Gita, my own, I would recommend this. Get as many translations and commentaries as possible. You know what somebody says immediately? Oh, I'd be confused. The more thoroughly confused you are, the better. Because then you would wonder, ooh, he says this, he says that, the other man says something completely contradictory. I found it now. That is it. That's what is necessary. Otherwise, you get hooked on to some ideology, some thought, and you build an image with that thought, with that ideology, with that person's thinking, and that's the end of it. It's better to read as many commentaries as possible.
So would you say as long as you can verbalize it, as long as you can conceptualize it, that's not it?
That's exactly, sir. As long as you can conceptualize it, it is not it. So I keep going, right? That's what you say. I keep going.
Do you say that this is the same with the guru-shishya relationship, or do you say that the shishya should have several gurus so that he can
advance? That's a bigger thing. You are using the word guru, I guess, in its connotation as a teacher. One can have as many teachers as one likes. A teacher for geography, a teacher for chemistry, and another for physics. And your geography teacher might become your tennis pupil. You know, that sort of thing is possible.
I'm talking in spiritual.
Yeah, that's what I say. So, in this sort of, as a teacher, you can have as many teachers as you like. But guru is a different thing altogether. Guru is light. One who enlightens you. One who enables you to attain enlightenment. One who points the way to enlightenment. One who awakes you spiritually. That person can only be one, I think. I don't know.
I've been practicing the Jiva Bandha for a while. And I think
what Bandha, sir?
Jiva Bandha.
Jiva Bandha. Uh-huh.
And I think I'm almost ready, with the help of Ben Spoon, to attempt Kachari Mudra. Is there any danger? If I can get it in, can I get it out by myself? Or if there's something
that would help me do it? I hope you can get out. But please, so long as there is fear, don't do it. So long as there is fear, pardon?
Does it block breath completely?
It doesn't block breath completely, but so long as there is fear, don't do it. Incidentally, I'm not discouraging you. I'm saying something, again, as usual, something comical. I've seen two or three people who have done this. It's a beautiful thing, you know, the cutting the frenum, lengthening the tongue so that it can be turned back and pushed into the nasal apertures. Most of us don't go to that extent, and even when we want to practice some kind of Kechari Mudra, we merely roll the tongue back and stick it as far back as possible. That is considered a practice which helps meditation. I was explaining this to a group of yoga students in Madagascar about 6-7 years ago. I said it's extremely difficult unless you sort of cut the thing and so on. And so, well, you don't have to go to the extreme limit, but try to push the tongue backward, roll the tongue backward. One French woman there, she looked at me as though I was some crazy creature. And immediately after the class, she came to me and said, "You said it is difficult. It is not difficult at all." I said, "What do you mean?" She just opened her mouth, pushed the tongue back, it disappeared. I was flabbergasted. And looked again, sure enough, she is born without the freedom. She had been born without this, you know, the freedom is the membrane that connects the base root of the tongue with the lower, the floor of the mouth. She's just born without it. So that by birth she is practicing Kechari. As a matter of fact, that is what spoiled my faith in Kechari Mudra. And then I looked at her little daughter, little one, 6 years. Open your mouth. She was also, probably it runs in the family. She also had no freedom, so that she could also push the tongue back. It's quite normal, except that speech is a bit heavy, slightly heavy. Otherwise, it's quite normal. But then I looked at them, can you fly in the air? Can you enter into samadhi? Nothing at all. They're just ordinary human beings. So there is something more to it. You must look for a teacher who practices this and then learn something more from him. Are there different religious paths, sir? I may not believe that. I may not believe those classifications. Yes, sir. I understand your question. I think it's very good for each one of us to be acquainted with all these and maybe one day it will click. You would either have made your choice or you would have perhaps got a sort of fruit salad made of all these, a bit of here, a bit of that, and a bit of that, and a bit of that, and a bit of this, and it may be a more balanced meal for you. Krishna is very specific in that respect. In the Bhagavad Gita, he says, the mind must be baffled. The more sure we are, this is the truth, the farther we are from the truth. The mind must be baffled. And then it comes to an end. It comes to the logical conclusion. You know what logical conclusion means? Conclusion of logic. Thank you.